So hello everyone, my name is Luc Trudel, and I'm with the LaRouche movement here in Montreal. And it's very interesting times we live in. Especially with the movement we're involved with, we're dealing with this, this very volatile situation in the world right now. And just think about this. I mean, there's nothing about the universe that is constant but change, but change itself. And the reason I'm starting with this idea is because our own movement, we've been used to dealing with a crisis, you know, that was supposed to come eventually, sometime. We didn't know when. Eventually, maybe. But now we're at a phase where a lot of the ways we've been used to is kind of... we have to switch gears. It's kind of like a phase shift in this whole development of the collapse. I guess that's one way to look at it, because I was just watching we have the website. I hope everybody is well aware of this website. By the end of the class, or by the end of the night, you should pretty much be very familiar with the importance of going to check out this website every day, every week if possible, if not possible every day. But I was checking the website, and we have a weekly update, a briefing that's given by some of our intelligence staff. This week was Jeff Steinberg. Well, it's actually usually Jeff Steinberg, but he had this guy, John Hoffel, with him. And he said something funny because, you know, he had to confess to the people who listened to his weekly update, and he said, you know, we used to do these things and record them the day before, and then you end up presenting it on the website the day after, but the people, they think that you just recorded it this morning. But you're moving in a situation where things are moving so fast that you might give the wrong impression to the people who's listening to this briefing that he's up to date, when really he's not up to date, because things have moved on so fast. So that's just, I mean, important to be aware that right now it's like we even have to readjust what we're doing, because like this is one example, but it came back. It came back up in the briefing tonight. We get a briefing on the phone, and we, you know, we've all seen the pamphlets we distribute, and now we're in a situation where we can't necessarily wait for a pamphlet to be produced, sent to all the locals. We have to go out with something from LaRouche whenever LaRouche intervenes, because he's dealing with the situation minute by minute. Because, and for those of you who are less familiar with LaRouche, hopefully we'll make it, we'll go through exactly what LaRouche represents and why there's so much attention that should be directed towards LaRouche and his organization right now, or why some people fear him a lot. So that's what I want to start out with today. And one of the first papers we're going to go out with and distribute to the people, you know, without waiting for, you know, the big order to come, we're going to go in with this idea that this short, something Lyndon LaRouche wrote today, and I just thought I'd read it out to you, because it's one of the latest things that came out on the website. How many people here have been on the website, by the way? Okay, so good. That's good. So LaRouche nails Bush crowd for bailing out their brutish friends. So this statement was put out September 25th. So Lyndon LaRouche today continued to assail the Bush administration's multi-trillion dollar bailout swindle, charging that the so-called Paulson plan would hand trillions of dollars in U.S. taxpayers' money to foreign financial interests, particularly British interests. Never before in history has any government proposed to use taxpayers' money to bail out the worthless paper of foreign investors, in particular the Europeans, led by the Bush family's brutish friends, he said. So LaRouche was referring to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's recent admission that the bailout swindle is to be extended to foreign holders of U.S. mortgage-backed securities and other toxic speculative paper. I know that George H.W. Bush is practically a British citizen. He did receive and delight in being knighted by the Queen herself. Is the Bush family being rewarded for behaving like pigs? LaRouche continued, it is obvious that Paulson is moving to have U.S. taxpayers bail out British and other European friends. This is illegal and unconstitutional, LaRouche warned. I pity any elected official who gets caught backing this foreign bailout scheme, LaRouche explained. The American population has suddenly become a very big factor in this crisis. This is not an organized repudiation of this swindler's bailout. It's instinctive. Suddenly, the American people are facing their worst nightmare. They are being told that they must sacrifice to save the rich. This doesn't fly. The killer reaction is already there, LaRouche concluded. So, that's what he says. Now, why does he say that? Right? Is anybody clear on why he would say that? Is this obvious? That this is stupid? It doesn't seem to be, right? There's a lot of people, if you tell them in the street, they wouldn't necessarily, you know, like, you wouldn't have millions of people right now agree with you. But then again, we live in a very, very disturbed culture, right?
So they're seeing the news, too. Like, there's this guy who said that we would put 700 billions to bailing out, but he said it's possible we don't need that amount of money, so everything's okay. It's not the truth. It's not reality.
Mm-hmm. So, what I'm going to try and go through now is really present like the latest series of failures in the economic system, just to go through exactly what is happening to this system, and before I do that, we our organization, first of all, was not born yesterday, right? So we have LaRouche, who's, first of all, he's from another generation, or two generations ago. He's from the generation of Franklin Roosevelt. So imagine a 25-year-old kid growing up when Franklin Roosevelt is president, compared to a 25-year-old kid growing up when George Bush is president. I mean, this question of leadership I guess can become interesting, because what are the people being inspired to do under Bush? Or what are people inspired or were inspired to do under Roosevelt? And the fact that we have LaRouche still alive, first of all, is special in itself. But the thing is, he's 86 years old. He's a patriot. He's an American. And he knows that, with all his experience as a human being, that it is possible to have a government develop a nation state. He knows more than any of us would know, because he's seen it. He lived it. He's seen the culture, the effects of the culture around you. We never saw that. We only saw, well, most of us, anyways, we only saw the process of an economy which went from, imagine a car going up a hill and stopping stopping the motor when it's almost up the hill, and then it has enough to go up the hill, and then at up the hill it only has enough to go in the curve downwards, and then it just collapses or it just goes down. The FDR intervention came in a point of a depression. What some people esteem is the kind of things we're facing right now, although they would be wrong. It's much worse. So you had the buildup of an economy which was creating a certain momentum, and the American economy was developing, the culture was developing, the education was developing, the morality was developing. And after Roosevelt's death, you still had the effects of the work, the institution in place, the regulation in place, which gave enough steam to the car, so to speak, our metaphoric car here, to still go up. Although it was no longer the policies of the government after Roosevelt, which was making the car go up, right? Because what came after LaRouche was President Truman.
After
Roosevelt. After Roosevelt. What did I say?
After LaRouche.
Sorry, yeah. Well, they're synonymous, almost. So you had Truman come in after Roosevelt had fought the Nazis. And, I mean, we can go back into that more in depth, into what exactly this Second World War was all about. But in terms of the economy, you really had the process start to fail once that Truman intervened. And Truman lacked what Roosevelt had in that spark of genius that Roosevelt had. Because it must have been this spark of genius that was missing, because, I mean, the same administration, I guess, was still there. The same people around, the bureaucrats, the workers. I mean, the workers were not better workers. They were not a different set of workers under FDR. So you have this these policies which lose track of what it is that we're fighting, or what it means to be human beings. So, let's go back to that car here. So in 1971, or in the late 60s, you had an economic system, through different reasons, there were interventions to create a floating exchange rate. So the floating exchange rate idea became a new introduction of a new economic principle of basically economic suicide. So basically, most of us would have been born after this phase. So that, getting back to this idea of the difference between LaRouche and ourselves, is that we've never had this leadership or an economy that was growing. So by having the policies of suicide for the economy, you had nations or everybody who wanted to make money started to see that one of the easiest ways to make money was through speculation. Because you could use money in one place, which was not performing as much, and putting in a stock market or a place where a lot of hype was being created, so that by the time everybody joined the fad, you had pulled out your money and you had made a profit. And some people call this the work of a great economist. Actually, Harvard developed those kinds of management schools. So imagine getting a degree from Harvard, which was a very reputable university, and telling everybody that, hey, we don't have to produce no more. We don't have to make things. Let's just use our money in a way, be wise and be cunning with our investments. And let's not think about what's going to happen to the other people or to the economy or our nation or if this is right or wrong or whatever. The important thing is we're making money. All right. So how can you compete with an investment which is guaranteeing money, or almost, some people will claim to guarantee money overnight or within short periods of time, with the kinds of money, the billions and trillions of dollars needed to build up the infrastructure? How can you compete with that? The infrastructure, just to get the process of deciding on a project and planning and everything else, takes some time. Takes some people. You have to hire those people. You have to get them working. You have to get permits. Things like that. So, billions of dollars over 25 to 50 years versus quick profit. Well, if you're electricity, you want to take the path of least resistance. And if you're a Wall Street banker, what do you think you want to do? Which one is you going to invest in? And plus, if you are going to make infrastructure because you want to do good, somehow you still manage to have this spark in you that you want to see the effect of your work mirrored into the culture, and see growth around you, and not only dead corpses and people on drugs and people listening to rave music or whatever. You still can invest in infrastructure, but then the stock market doesn't give you stability because it's a floating exchange rate. People are trading all the commodities on a daily basis. And then people start introducing futures market on gas and food and carbon. So what you think is going to, what your investment you think is going to cost, let's say, $40 billion, calculate how much money it's going to be if it becomes maybe 12% interest on a yearly basis, but maybe 4%, but maybe 20% some other time. Or maybe the goods you need to build are going to, maybe if you need steel, the price is going to go up. Maybe you depended on a steel manufacturer in Ontario or in Pittsburgh, and now this industry has disappeared. It went away to China, or it was just disappeared from the map of the world. So now the cost, there's a rarity, right? Supply and demand all of a sudden. Now you don't have the industries. I mean, there's still somebody out there that's going to sell you what you need. It's going to be more expensive. Maybe you can buy it. Maybe somebody else can't buy it no more. So some people manage to do pretty good. And others fall between the cracks. They are not able to adapt to the system. Well, can we get back to that a bit later? So the point I'm making is that this is the reality of what we've been used to. I mean, this is the environment in which we grew up in, so that our governments, most of them, to have a job or to be elected and have the support of the corporate money to be elected, you have to be incompetent a lot of times. Because any competent people, or somebody who knows economics, is going to say, wait a minute, there's something wrong in the very nature of our system. We need to change that first, and then we can do... Like, let's start with what's important, the fundamental. Like, our system needs to be a good system, because we're going to build upon it. It's like a foundation, right? So we end up with people who are willing to compromise. They're saying, well, hey, this guy says he's going to give me the money for my campaign if I just shut up about those crazy ideas I have. And I'm still going to represent the people. I'm still going to be listening to them and listening to their stories and saying, you know, what do you need? Oh, yeah, sympathize with you. Oh, yes. I'm still going to try to make my party win the elections. But what about the principles? What is it that we're doing here? I mean, people want to know. Most people still haven't figured out what we're doing here on Earth. Shouldn't we have leadership that answers this question? People want to know. Give them what they want. Anyways, LaRouche is doing this. But he makes us work for it. He doesn't want to give it all to us. And so... I'll leave you to think about that for a while. Now, getting back to this crisis, starting around September 17th, we had the Lehman Brothers, which was having difficulties. They were trying to get a buyer, and that didn't work. Merrill Lynch was bought up. And then you have AIG.
Who bought Merrill Lynch?
Bank of America. And then you have AIG, which is an insurance giant. So you have all these people, and none of them are actually real companies, in a way. They think they're important. Most people would be impressed to meet somebody with a suit and a business card with AIG, or to show their mommy and daddy that they work for a big company, right, on Wall Street or something. But what do they actually do, these people? I mean, Lehman Brothers bought a bunch of mortgage-backed securities. This whole speculation business was this idea of speculation. And you had a system which, in order to print money, had to create a debt. And so, in the 1990s, you had the system was about to collapse. And then the chairman of the Fed, the new chairman of the Fed came in, Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan said, okay, we're going to do this banking bubble. This housing. We're going to lower the interest rates very much. We're going to tell people to buy houses. And we're going to tell them that it's a safe investment. As long as people keep buying houses, the price is going to go up. And so even if you don't have the money to buy your house, you can get the mortgage. You get the loan. Anybody will loan you the money because everybody expects the price to go up. And then we can sell those bunch of mortgages, these packages of mortgages. And then companies who are not real banks, they're just investment banks. They're not chartered. They buy these products and they sell them to speculators. And then the thing is, you can be investing in Lehman Brothers, and then you say, maybe what I'm buying is crap. Because maybe the price of homes are not going to go up forever. Maybe. And so, well, maybe I want a guarantee for that. So you have other friends who studied with you at Harvard who work with AIG. And you say, hey, what if I lose a bunch of billions of dollars? You want to help me out? Sure. I'm willing to bet that you're not going to lose your money. But if you do, I'm going to cover your loss. And then some people bet on those papers. You can imagine this going on forever. It's like LaRouche, one of the first webcasts I listened was June 2005. And LaRouche talks about this idea that the great American economy, the greatest superpower of the world, which started as you know, founding fathers, very literate in science and in revolutionary ideas of the Renaissance. This great idea, the symbol of freedom for all human beings of the world. The industrialization of a nation. The Roosevelt building up of the capacity of the biggest war machine that helped defeat Hitler. That nation today, or in this recent years, basically don't produce much of anything today. So you have these it's like the whole economy of the United States is focused on a game of craps, LaRouche says, you know, in this webcast that I listen to.
Game of what?
Craps. It's a kind of New York City kind of game where you find people in an alley, you know.
Yeah, it's three cards and you have to mix them up and try to find the third card.
Okay. Yeah. So you have people, and they're saying, you know, give me $5, try to find the little thing, the card, you know? And then this this guy thinks he can do it, so he's willing to bet $5. And then you have other people who are listening on the side, and they're saying, I think he's not going to make it. Well, somebody says,
pay you $10, he will.
That's right. And so this goes on and on and on and on and on. And then everybody thinks, hey, I'm making money at this. I'm not going to work tomorrow. I'm going to see the crap game. I'm going to sit in front of a crap game because now I'm involved. I've made so much money. I'm going to have myself a computer. And I'm going to have the crap game playing on the computer. And then sometimes I'll win and I'll be happy. Sometimes I'll lose and I'll be very sad. I'll compensate. I'll go drink. I'll go do drugs. I'll go find myself a prostitute. I'll go find something to do. You gotta do something. I was feeling down. Gotta feel up. There's something to help you out. We have something for you in this economy, in this culture. Because, hey, we have to entertain the people who are making money. Because what else are they living for? I mean, you got to make money.
So you can pay for your entertainment.
That's right. So, so AIG, that represents what, $88 billion? Bailout? It's hard to tell, really, when you hear these numbers, what that represents. But meanwhile, you have people who have jobs, you know, real jobs, important jobs. People like Ben Bernanke, you know, and Henry Paulson, you know, and they're saying, hey, Ben, aren't you the Federal Reserve Chairman? Yeah. Hey, Hank, aren't you the Treasury Secretary? Yeah. Aren't we in doo-doo? Aren't we in shit right now? Yeah. Let's go party. So what do? They rent out a cottage for the weekend. They hang out. It's kind of like this movie called Weekend at Bernie's. Have you ever seen that? But apparently this movie, you have this party, and it's like kids or whatever, they have a party, and then this guy dies.
The host
dies. So think as the host, as the American body or the American economy, and they're having a party for the Americans, right? Because obviously the Americans are paying them. They're working for the government. And then the guy dies, but the party continues. And they're like, I don't see anything wrong. And all these people, when they are asked on the media or by the media, you hear this on CNN or whatever, they ask him, like, what's going on with the economy? You know, could anyone have predicted this? And then, no, nobody could have predicted this. This was unforeseen. This is never happens. Or it is just a correction. You know, sometimes these things happen, and we don't exactly know why, but they happen. So, but the thing is, that's not true. They're lying. They're a bunch of liars. Because you have Lyndon LaRouche, who is a living economist, who his whole career, but most specifically 14 months ago, he had a webcast. That was July 25th, 2007. And he said, okay, the party's over, the system is coming down, it's time that you guys listen to me because I know what I'm doing. Not only do I know what I'm doing, I know what a real economy is, I've lived under Roosevelt. You guys are amateurs. And you're going to have to do what I tell you, or else things are going to get worse and people are going to get hurt really bad.
And he was a little more emphatic than that. He said that the collapse has happened, it's occurred, and at this point there is no possibility
of a non-collapse.
Of a non-collapse. That was 14 months ago.
So 72 hours after, you have this webcast, and 72 hours after LaRouche said the system is finished, okay, to give you an idea of how things moved quickly from that point on, you had the first tremors, the first, what you could call the rigor mortis shock, you know, when the dead bodies convulsion. You had Countrywide, a big mortgage seller or mortgage bank, announced the bankruptcy. You later had the Bear Stearns problem, the Bear Stearns collapse. And so that was beginning in the news of like, there's a mortgage bubble collapse. This is the beginning of a crisis. But they never really understood what had happened, because they looked at it from the standpoint of a mortgage collapse, which it never was, actually. So, but by that time, or like before the beginning of August, you had the bubble, the big hyperinflation bubble, 38 years, 39 years of badly run economy, the bubble had burst. Or at least the housing part, which was going to bring about the death of the whole system. So that from that point on, the system was dead. And so the system was gone. Nothing can be repaired. You can't bail it out. And then when you think of like what happened in Germany in 1923, in Weimar, where they had this big hyperinflation collapse because of their physical economy was destroyed. That was a big precedent in the human history. But by comparison to this, that was nothing. What we're seeing today is bigger than that by a long shot. And so LaRouche, really, he didn't waste time. He said, okay, I have a new plan. We're gonna introduce this legislation. We're going to go around the whole nation of the United States. And it's going to be the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. And before they went to all these people, they went to show it to people who, you know, to get the feedback of the people in Congress. Yeah, you had some senior members of Congress, some senior economists, and all these people said, you know, it's going to work. The way it's presented, it addresses the problem the right way, and this can work. We can work with this. We can pass this legislation. And so they had a big, massive mobilization. City councils were signing up, introducing this motion. Young people like ourselves were introducing this by traveling from city to city, talking to the city councils in all these American cities. And if it wasn't a city council, it was a state Congress. Several states, hundreds of cities signed on to this. The people the population were supporting this. This was not like something that people could not understand. They understood, because basically what the point of the law or the policy was, you have, basically the name says it all. You have a homeowners who have ended up with bad mortgages, who can't afford them no more, but they get to stay in their homes. But the banks, if they're not getting the full money that they're owed to them, they're going to default. So we need to protect these guys too. Because not for their sake, not to save people who gamble their money, but you want to have something in place for those people who still buy groceries and still pay their rent. And so you're going to have a legislation which keeps people in their homes, and then you have people pay something. what, at least something they can afford to stay in their home. And so, but the thing with this HBPA is that it was going to introduce other needed legislations, which is kind of like the you can think about it in a way that how the ruthless free traders or policymakers for people like Felix Rohatyn or people like George Soros or whatever, whenever these guys are supporting policies, they usually present policies, and then they write a report or the law so thick that you're able to insert in it a bunch of bad toxic pills into the bill. But in the other way, what we're doing with this is saying, let's save the homeowners and the banks, and that is your intention, right? And everybody agrees. But now the surprise kicker is that to do this in the long term, we have to change the system. So if you start out saying to people, we're going to change the system, they might not necessarily understand. But you tell them, that's the only way we can save your home. That's the only way we can save your banks. We have to change the system. So what are we talking about? So we're talking about going from a floating exchange rate system, a post-Bretton Woods globalized system of free trade, unbridled speculation, money laundering, corruption, tax evasion, all that stuff. You're going from that, and you go to fixed exchange rates between nations. You go to a two-tiered credit system. So you want to have a very cheap interest, or very cheap money for the good things in life, like putting people to work. But not just anything, of any kind of work. You want them to build their nation in the most intelligent way possible. In accordance to the understanding of real physical economy principles. You want to create all this money so that the bridges that are collapsing get replaced, so that all the water pipes that are bursting get replaced, so that new high-speed rail transportation gets built, so that massive networks of energy, nuclear energy, often the case, gets built. Not only for what we need today, but for what we need in our future generations. In terms of giving ourselves the means to develop ourselves even better in the future. Or giving ourselves a greater power over the universe in a lawful way. That's why we need the science of physical economy. That's why all these people studying economics in universities are being ripped off. Because if they're learning something about the economy in a system which is not eternal, which is temporary at best, we still haven't trained people to be real economists and figure out what are the best investments to do? What is the best way to spend our money if we're going to create it? If we're going to be accountable for it, right? If we create this new system and we have cheap credit, it's like the government saying that we'll repay this debt. How we're going to repay it is by gaining the added productivity from the very investment we're building. The very infrastructure we're building is going to help us increase our power even more. So basically you have this two-tiered system, which is, you know, the cheap interest rates for the good stuff, and then a very high interest rate. You want to keep it as high as possible for the people who are really desperate for speculation.
Gamblers.
Huh? For the gamblers, right. You want to make it so expensive.
They'll never gamble again.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I mean, it's like basically regulating. If you're going to have a government in the first place, do we want it to be arbitrary? Do we want the idea of the government to change from day to day, like it's doing right now, changing the values of what we think is important from day to day? If we look at the news one day, it says that we like gold. If we look at the news another day, it says that we don't like it as much. So if we change our minds about that all the time, what is it we don't change our minds about? The fact that we're human beings? Do we always agree that we are first and foremost human beings and not animals? Do we agree on that?
What do you mean by human being?
What's that word?
We can explore this question.
Explain.
We can explore. I won't go into all those deep questions, although they're very interesting. And maybe Rob will get into those questions more in depth, because Rob has prepared a class on universal history. But basically, we're going to let the brokerage houses, you know, the Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys, the Merrill Lynch, the Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, if we're successful, because obviously there's nothing guaranteed in what I'm saying right now. I mean, it may sound nice, it may sound like it makes some sense, but for some reason, there's a fight, because some people have been making it a pretty good living from stealing. And somehow they don't want to stop. And they find ways to incite people or trouble people with a moral dilemma. They're saying, hey, I have cash for you if you're willing to be the devil. You want the cash? Or do you fear perhaps being killed by your fellow human beings who are gonna kill you if you take my cash? Because that's what's going on. We had this the Henry Paulson thing. Because actually, if somebody has the Tenth Amendment to try treason, we can show it later. But the thing is, we had the yeah, sure. This is the newest pamphlet we received in Montreal, but it's been out a few days or maybe a week from now. By now, but this is really the focus point of what our attention must be at right now, because you have a proposition, or actually, you've had the work has been, these sneaky guys have prepared the way for a trick, you know, to be played upon the American population. It comes under the name of a bill called the Frank Dodd Bill. And that bill basically sets up the possibility of creating, transforming Hank Paulson from somebody who's accountable to Congress and accountable to the U.S. citizen and the president, to somebody who would be floating in a new space of unaccountability with a license to print money in orders of magnitude greater than anybody's imagination to bail out banks, namely Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were the banks buying up the mortgages for people's homes, right? buying up all the bad mortgages they ended up doing. And people were speculating on this from all over the world. And now he's willing to use a new law, a new powers given to him by Congress, to basically bail out the bad investments of people who are not even American citizens.
Isn't it normally the president who should be making such decisions about how to use? Isn't what you're saying that Hank Paulson's going to be given the power of creating credit?
Well, not exactly. But actually, he wants, or this bill hasn't passed yet. That's what we have going for us. But you have to understand that this bill would have passed, perhaps, if there wasn't a guy like LaRouche out there kicking people in the butt, you know? An old guy kicking everyone in the butt and telling him, hey, do you know what this is going to do? Why aren't you fighting this? You're going to go along just because everyone is stupid? You're going to go along with them? We had just like this, what I said about the website. You had LaRouche pull out one of these memos, his interventions into the culture with this collapse, and then he said, "We got to stop this thing. The Frank Dodd bill will kill us. We'll be the end of the United States. So we got to stop that." And here you had most of the Congress was ready to pass for it, to sign on the bill, and because they had not been in reality, they were still in Washington, where everybody they confirm the illusions that other people have. You know, you're in Washington, you want to believe that this is just another correction in the system, that no big deal. But then you go meet your people, your constituency, in your own, what we would call a writing, and your people, they're telling you, are you crazy? Stop this shit. This is crazy. We don't want to bail out bad speculators. We don't want our children's children to pay off this debt. It can't be repaid. Stop it. You have people who started calling their congresswoman, like thousands of phone calls. And they're like 95% against, and maybe the 5% for, or maybe they're paid to call by Republicans, or I don't know who. But not only Republicans, obviously.
You think with all that free cash, they could up the percentage a little?
But the point is that you have people who are smarter than we think they are. The real people are smarter than the congresswomen at this, the congressmen or the people at this time. It used to be that the people in Congress were leading the show, and that the people would, oh yeah, okay, we'll follow that, and it makes sense. But now it's like the Congress people saying, hey, our population is asking us something. Where is this coming from? Well, this population doesn't get ideas. You never have a culture get ideas on its own. You have, the way it happens, you have the ideas which are always made in the not to get into this. The point is, we're organizing the population. And you have LaRouche leading the fight, who knows what he's doing. And there's no guarantee that we can win this thing, but the thing is to understand that this is not a game. And we have to stop this. And just whatever you're going to say about this bill to your friends is important. You don't want to be telling or perpetuating bullshit. You want to know what you're talking about. Because people have no idea. They listen to the news. They don't tell you anything there. Or they might tell you a little bit, but not the important stuff. So, basically, I could go into more things, like technical things, but basically, once you have the two-tiered system, you're going to have to go send somebody. It doesn't have to be, at this time, we don't know if there's going to be an American election. Okay? Things are moving very fast, as I mentioned. So you want to have senior people in Congress. Senior, former, high-level government position people like Bill Clinton or Bob Rubin or people like that. You want these guys to wake up and to go into the White House and, you know, go up to George Bush and realize that they're dealing with a mental midget, you know? Okay, and they're going to tell him, you know, listen, guy, get out of the way. We're dealing with a situation where obviously you don't know what you're doing. We're going to take over. I mean, you don't know what can happen, but you want to get everybody involved in this fight somehow and realize that you're going to have to be creative with how you deal with this. But basically, once you get something rolling, once you get something going, you're going to go see Russia, China, India, and with the United States, you're going to propose something which, if you propose, they'll accept. You're going to propose that with these four nations, we can basically start a new economic system worldwide. And that means that we have a new fixed interest rate system. No floating exchange rate. No speculation no more. It's going to be based on knowledge and science, not knowable investments. And all these nations are going to be sovereign in this thing. It's not going to be one person leading and then the other buddies following. It's going to be a principle of cooperation, a dynamic of collaboration, and each nation will have new powers of credit, the creation of credit for the development of their own nation. Obviously, there's going to be some little things to agree on, like things like a parity price to be established for, let's say, 15, 20 years or 30 years or something like that, to be renegotiated after a while. But you have this community of people who can agree to cooperate to save civilization and avoid a dark age. That should be a good motivation and a good reminder if ever the discussions get out of whack that this is what's going on.
Two questions. First, what's prosperity? Can you answer that after? And second, what happens to the old groupings that exist already? European Union, Mercosur, APEC,
okay,
organization, so on and so forth, that already don't seem to be as much in trouble as the U.S. But I understand that you can't talk about the U.S. only, it will be a global collapse. But how do you involve them?
Well, that's what I was going to get to. I mean, the idea is that you have these four nations who have a history of this tradition who have an idea of what it means to be a sovereign nation, basically. The United States, Russia, China, and India. Now, a lot of people have silly ideas concerning Russia. A lot of people like, and I'll get back to your question a bit later, a lot of people have, you know, grew up in this mental warfare state of the culture, where you're presented with this idea of like 20, 30 years of a Cold War or something. And so the Russians are an enemy somehow, and we are on the side of the Americans because we're in North America, and these guys, they speak differently, and they're weirder.
They drink differently.
Yeah. But what's important to realize is it can be summed up, actually, what Prime Minister Putin said in an interview in the French newspaper. And he said that every time the world has seen a grave crisis, the United States and Russia have been on the same side. That's interesting. He cited specifically the example of Abraham Lincoln. He said, "We hope that our friends in the U.S. remember this and that we can do it again." Because you have this history that we're talking about of the Russians collaborating with the United States. It goes like you had the example. Like at the Russian army had helped the United States during the American Revolution, and the Catherine. Okay, so you had the Russians help out during the American Revolutions because they said they were staying in the waters near the United States and they wanted to keep the British Army from intervening. I'm getting things mixed up because another example was during the Civil War, you had Catherine the Great organize the League of Armed Neutrality and to help the American Revolution during the Civil War. The Russians' navy was docked in New York and San Francisco with orders that if the British entered the war on the side of the Confederacy, then not only would the Russians go under the command of President Lincoln, but the Russians would also, in Europe, go against those powers, particularly the British, backing the efforts to destroy the United States, to back up the Union and create, so the British were going to destroy the United States to break up the Union and create this Confederate monstrosity. So you have this idea of Russia collaborating with the United States, and that Putin wants us to all remember that this has been the tradition. It's kind of like saying, hey, remember, we've always been friends. Let's remember who the real enemy is. And remember that LaRouche is always referring to this notion of the British Empire.
How come the Russians are so slow to denounce the British Empire?
That's a good question. LaRouche is kicking them in the butt too, the Russians. To everybody. Everybody's
good. The British really know.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's the thing. A lot of people don't know how to think about this. The thing is, you have LaRouche is 86 years old. How many people are leading the world right now who's 86 years old? Who's sane? Who has a memory of participating in these changing by fighting in the army, by advising the Congress, by being in 8-9 presidential campaigns. So the sense of history in LaRouche is very strong, and that's what he's trying to, as one of the things he's doing to intervene in our culture today, and make sure that we have the right understanding of how to think about the situation in which we're in, because there's nothing to fear but fear itself, but there's nothing to fear than completely irrational thinking, which is what our culture wants us to do. And we're out to organize a certain order in our thoughts here. And so, this is a... could be more to be said, but I guess we'll leave some of the floor for Rob, who's going to talk about this go into a more of this understanding of universal history as a greater arc of how to look at how we come to live a crisis like this today, and also understand that this is not the first time that humanity has been tested. And sometimes we fail, but sometimes we break through a certain limit. And these are times, like I said, I want to just go back to what I said in the beginning of this briefing, that we are in a time of a very much a lot of volatility, and things are going to move very fast from now on, as they have been going on. Exponentially, as we have seen since LaRouche's webcast of July 25th, 2007, when he announced that the system was dead. So the system is dead, but we're still seeing pieces of the economy falling off. And before there's nothing left, there's still a chance to organize a recovery. So let's do that. All right.